very nice. So far in this retreat, I was talking about Silas and Satipa Kamala, and yesterday teaching just how we can use that to really relax our body, and to also start looking at the peaceometer in our mind, so we can learn how to get some more peace during this retreat. And I asked you to check that during the daytime. How peaceful are you? Is it going in the correct direction? Are you getting more tense, more anxious? Because I know that some people go on retreat, and afterwards when they come home, they're much worse than what they're there must be something wrong there. But if you go home after being so peaceful and kind, then it's obviously something good is happening here. And also, if you're more tense and more anxious, there's something going wrong here. Because peace of mind is what we're trying to gain here. Now, peace of mind all the way to Nirvana, a big peace of mind. And as we develop that more and more, we get more peaceful, more still, more happy, and we start to be going in the correct direction. And as similarly, which just comes up, I know that Andy's talked, but I want to talk about Anapanasati, because many people always ask, am I going in the correct direction? Is the meditation working? And what's happening? And the best simile I've come up with was a simile from my life when I was a young monk. Well, sorry, not a young monk, but a student. And even then, when it became the vacations, if I wasn't working trying to get some money to pay my bills, I was off usually in the wilderness of Scotland. So I loved that place during the summertime. There you could find some solitude. And sometimes I would spend days and days up in the mountains by myself, just meditating, living simply. And it was just my character. So, I was staying in the youth hostel once, way up in the northwest of Scotland, and a very beautiful sunny day, no rain, weather looked beautiful, so with the warden of the local hostel who knew the area, we decided to go for a walk up to the top of one of the mountains. Maybe a couple of hours, it's not that tall, not that high. And when we got to the top, sat down, beautiful view, just enjoying everything. And then afterwards I saw another mountain and said, ah, let's go to that one as well. And he said, no, I've had enough of the day, I'm going back. So I went up to the second mountain by myself, which is always a big mistake. You always have to have a friend with you in case nothing goes wrong. And for me, it wasn't that I didn't trip and break my leg or anything like that, but what happened, the weather changed so incredibly quickly, I just couldn't believe how fast the clouds came in from the ocean and how some of those clouds went way over the mountain, which I was almost at the top of, and it just came so quickly down that I was enveloped in mist and so thick you could not see the hand in front of you. And I was worried at first because I believed, well, I know my sense of direction. What I need to do is to retrace my steps and go down the mountain, I'll be quite safe. And so I decided to do that, retracing my steps. And then I became incredibly scared because I was one step away from this vertical cliff which went a long way down. One more step and I would be here. So I realized I was totally lost because I didn't remember any cliffs like that on the way up. It taught me the first lesson is that we all think we have a sense of direction, but we don't. You ask your husband, which is the way back? That's why we have GPSs, because we don't have senses of direction, especially if you're up in the mountains. So that got a bit worried, because I had heard tales of people who've been lost in those mountains for 3 or 4 days. And really surprised when they actually walked out without any injury, without any hypothermia. Because they were really cold and were wet. And you know, you lose your body temperature so quickly. And so of course when it got dark, you wouldn't know where to go. And there's many cliffs there and rocks, and it's a very dangerous place to be. So I got scared. But then I thought, how can I escape from this mist where you can't see more than sort of a couple of feet in front of you? And then I had this amazing insight, because I studied physics, and I used my science. Water always grows downhill. I've never yet seen water flow backwards. So I decided to find a little stream, maybe a tiny little brook first of all, and follow it, because I knew it would always lead down, down, down. And I could actually see the brook, but I couldn't see much further than that. And so I followed that little brook down, enjoyed another brook, became a little stream, followed that down, kept on following it around all over the place. But because it was always going down, I knew that it would go down far enough that it would soon go underneath the mist. And of course that's what happened. I got down the mountain far enough, I was below the mist, below the clouds, and then I could get my directions. I could see where I was. I could find my way home. And I use that as a simile in meditation or in the spiritual life. We are like in the mist for many, many years of our life. We're not quite sure what we're supposed to be doing. This one says that, another nun says something else. What on earth are we supposed to do? Who should we believe? They're all good people. So we wonder just how can we find our way in the right direction. So you follow a stream. As you know, water always goes in one direction, always goes down. And so the stream which I ask you to follow in meditation is the stream of peace, kindness, and clarity. Peace, kindness, and clarity. Or happiness there as well. Because if those things are getting stronger and stronger, getting more peaceful, more happiness, those two go together. More kindness, more clarity, it means you're going in the correct direction. If you're getting more frustrated, more upset, then you're going in the wrong direction. That's not the leading to nirvana. If you're getting more ill will, that's not going to lead to nirvana. If you're getting more sort of confusion, it's not leading anywhere. But if you have these indicators, like peace is the best indicator. Because if you keep developing more and more peace, that will always lead to nirvana. If you're developing more kindness, that also always leads to nirvana. And more happiness. You can't really fake happiness. People try and get drugs, take drugs to fake happiness. But the real happiness is something which, you know, is so real, you cannot fake it. And it's when it starts to grow, you really notice that very easily. Insight is very hard to notice. Simply because everybody's got their views and ideas, and we all think, I'm right, no you're not, you're right. But people used to have an argument in Thailand, my master, Ajahn Chah, would look at two of them. They're having an argument, he said, you, monk, you are right, but not correct. You are correct, but not right. It's one way we know it, we've all got part of the truth, we can't have the whole truth, that's why we argue. That is not sort of leading onto the path of nirvana. So it's not how well you can argue with your friends over a cup of coffee about the Dhamma. That's no sign that you're enlightened or in the right path. The sign is like peace, kindness, happiness. Those are the indicators. So just like I was following the stream downhill, you follow those indicators, I become more peaceful. I become kinder, happier. Then, if so, you're following the right path. And soon that leads down until you go underneath the mist, which in its simile actually means becoming a stream. And then you can actually see anything. You know what the path is. You understand how it all works. Underneath the mist. But the only way to get to that stage is just to follow in the streams of peace and kindness, clarity, and what's the number one happiness? Those ones are what take you in that direction. So that's just the start of it. Now, having made it very clear, now I'll continue to confuse you. Because, talking about relaxing the body, relaxing the mind, the biggest problem always in meditation is just getting to that stage where you have enough mindfulness, enough peace to do things like watching the breathing. And of course, we're still only a couple of days into this retreat, so it's still difficult for some of you. either hopefully the sleepiness should have mostly been overcome after a couple of days of doing the Ananda method of enlightenment, which hasn't worked, at least you're caught up as to sleep. At least that's getting a bit more physically relaxed. But of course the opposite of the spots and torpor is the restlessness, the thinking so much, which is always a very difficult thing for people to overcome. Now please never blame yourself. You know, that you think too much. It's not your fault. I blame my school teachers. I was a school teacher myself. And I remember when the teacher would say to me, said, what do you think of that? Nothing. Stupid. And I was always taught that thinking is being clever and being still is being stupid. Oh, I could have got in life much quicker if I had to school. So we've been encouraged to think, to think, to think. That's become a habit. And because of that, it's so difficult in today's world for people to try another way of understanding the world. And another way of perceiving it and actually seeing deeper into it. The way of silence. So this is actually how we try and develop another way of cognition. Not thinking, thinking. And seeing the world through concepts. Of seeing the world through experience. Which is one of the reasons why we do encourage the walking meditation. And when you're doing the walking meditation, either downstairs or in the corridors, up on the roof, any place you can find, I don't need to actually walk that far, I need to do it in my room. It's nice and quiet in there. So you do your walking meditation, you start off at the beginning, and you put your gaze about 2 meters in front of you. You only do that so to make sure you don't bump into the wall, which you're focused on. It gives you the sense of safety. And you don't look to the left, don't look to the right, just roughly, you know, like a body's left in front of you. And that's all, with your eyes open. Sometimes people say, can we close our eyes in walking meditation? You can do, but I'm taking no responsibility for your bumps and bruises and cuts and injuries when you hit the wall. Good to keep the eyes open, but not the left, not the right, just in front of you. And then you walk naturally. You don't go trying to get the world record in the slowest walking position. You just naturally, you just walk. Sometimes, especially if you've got some indigestion or you really feel you need to exercise, you can walk fast. And many of those great monks in Thailand do fast walking meditation. People like Ajahn Mah Bua. When you saw him on the walking path, it was like looking at the F1 cars down by the Calais Airport. Really fast. Burning up the track. Sometimes you can see smoke and flames coming down. But he was a really fast walker. And other people do it slower. It really depends upon you and nature what you need. So you just walk. How do you walk? You know how to walk. Why do you have to do things differently just because it's meditation? Just walk. Your job in walking meditation is not to do the walking. The body does that. Your job is to do the watching. The observing. Imagine you are like somebody who works in a big factory. But your job is not to be on the production line and doing all those little tasks. Your job is to be the supervisor. The consultant. You don't do anything. You just watch and tell other people when they're doing things wrong. What a great job that is. That's what I wanted to do. You know, I thought I could retire after 40 years, become consultant. So I just go to other monasteries and be a consultant. Then go to other people's meditation retreats and tell them what they're doing wrong. Because, I was on the production line. So anyway, it was like a slave. But anyway, in a walking meditation, you're just like the supervisor, you're not the worker. So you just watch and see what's happening. And as you're watching, it doesn't mean thinking about stuff. Observe.
What is it like to walk? What muscles have to move, and how do they move?
So when you do walking meditation, to get people aware, mindful of the walking, I ask some of these little tests. People do like tests in Malaysia. And so the test is three questions. Number one, what part of your foot leaves the ground first? Can you walk? Now you can't remember this, you have to go and do it. And when you finish one step, what part of the foot leaves the ground first? What part is it? Toe, is it heel, what is it? And when you are walking, how does your feet move through the air? Is it like straight up, and then horizontal, and then down? Or is it like up this way, and up and down this way, and back down this way? How does it move? Can you observe it well enough that afterwards you can come in here and do a little diagram how your foot moves through space in one spot, when one step? And are both feet the same when they move? All this is doing is giving something interesting to find out, so you do become more aware, more mindful of the movement of the feet and how you walk. And after a little while, you become so honestly fascinated by all the different movements in your legs and in your hips just for one step. It's an amazing how complicated a process that is. Now you may take it for granted now, but you look at a little sort of a one-year-old kid learning how to walk for the first time and just how difficult it is for them. But eventually they learn how to do it. So much balancing, so much attention to the muscles, that's actually what you need to do. So become aware of that again. Now, because you're aware of physical sensations, movement, it is part of the first step of the time. Because you're actually aware of all the physical body moving this way and that way, it blocks out all the thoughts. If you're thinking about your negative origination and all the Abhidharma on it, then you're not paying attention to the walking. You're walking anyway, bumping some things, you trip over stuff. If you're thinking about a relationship, or should you go and get a counselor or marriage or just give up, of course, you're being aware of your feet and you're walking. When I was young monk in Thailand, myself and all the other Western monks were always stubbing our toes on tree roots or cutting the feet on sharp stones in the forest. So much so that our feet were usually covered in band-aids. I usually had about six or seven at any one time. Other monks had more. The Thai monks didn't have any cuts on their feet. And Ajahn Chah was really amazed. How come you Western monks always cutting your feet and stubbing your toes? And he said, I figured it out. You Westerners have got stupid feet. And what a beautiful way of saying it. It's absolutely true. Our feet were stupid. We were all up in our head. Up here, oh, we're really aware of what's going on up here. When it came down to down here, we were totally unaware of what was going on down here. We stubbed this, put our feet onto that, cut it. After a while, after a few hundred band-aids, you soon got wide feet. But it just actually showed how many of us have also got stupid feet. So when you go down to walking meditation, you are actually learning how to have smart feet. So you can walk well. You can walk gracefully. You can walk almost effortlessly. People who are dancers. I don't know if you can dance. If you try dancing, a lot of times you make a fool of yourself. Simply because down here you're not really aware of, you're not sure of the muscles, you don't know how to let them flow. And that's why, because say you can't dance if you're a young person. I would try dancing now if I was my age. I might wreck something. That's why monks don't dance. Most of the good ones are too fat. So,
magic, I jumped out dancing. just the thought of it is quite shocking. How about singing? You know, one of my Malaysia disciples in Perth, she really put me on the spot once. She invited me to a fundraiser, I think it was for the Cancer Support Association. A really good cause. Can you come and give a talk and do something? Yeah, sure. You know, I sort of don't mind. You know, people raise funds for my monastery, why can't I raise funds for others? Fair, fair. So I went up to a nice charity. It was like a buffet. So of course I couldn't eat anything. But then when they got onto the fundraising stuff, I'm glad I never mentioned this to you earlier, Victor, otherwise you can probably ask me to do this on Saturday night. And they said, you know, it's very rare to see Ajahn Brahm or rather hear him sing a song. Ajahn Brahm, can you please sing something for charity? And they started, you know, so, okay, I'll give like $500 if you sing. 1,000, 2,000, I don't know how much it went up to. They were willing to give a really big donation to charity if I would sing a song. That really put me on the spot. If I said no, then I'd be really mean and they'd lose a bit of money. But you should never try and outwit a monk. I came up with a perfect solution. And I said to them, okay, yes, I will sing a song for you. As long as I can sing, I can choose the song I sing. I said, okay, fine. I think it was $3,000 or $4,000 or something. I said, okay, I will choose the song. And $3,000, $4,000. No, call the money off, write out the check first of all. And then I said, the song I'm going to sing is an old favourite, a classic from Simon and Garfunkel. It's called The Sound of Silence. and then I was quite convinced that it's okay, I got it. That's my version of the Sound of Silence by Simon. Never try to write me a book. That was a close one. So anyway, there we go. Not dancing, not singing, but we're actually walking. And we become quite aware of our feet. And while that does, it blocks out all the thoughts. Because we cannot really be watching our feet and thinking about things at the same time. It's called in Buddhism, it's called, you know, just replacements of one thing with another thing. And this is great. If that doesn't work, sometimes I ask people to maybe just go up to the top story, you know, outside, and feel the wind. Because when you're feeling the wind, it's cold. You can't think. Because you're alive. You're feeling stuff. When you are walking, for goodness sake, take off your socks. So you can actually feel the floor. Now, most modern people, we become insulated from the real world, from nature. Suppose the last time you got totally soaked wet. Sometimes these days we use umbrellas or in cars. We're not actually in the world anymore. When's the last time you got really dirty when you walked through some forest and you've got mud all over you? And it feels really good to actually be down and dirty and real in nature. Sometimes we just keep isolating ourselves, so we don't feel the body. Because we're so isolated, that's why it's so easy to think. So that's one of the reasons why, if you really are thinking a lot, just try maybe just take your shoes off, go to the top and just walking in the rain, in the water. Get wet. You go back to your room, take a shower afterwards, it's not bad for your health. It's just like getting real again, getting away. There's a, I'm always interested in psychology and just the different techniques which people have in psychology to help people. And this, sometimes I look at him as a scallywag, sometimes say a wise person, but it's one of those people who say, why didn't we think of that? Because he had many people who came to him, depression, anxiety, you know, the usual emotional illnesses of our modern age. And his therapy, he called it nature therapy. All he did is get his clients, come in the car,
He would take them down to the beach, or walk along the cliffs, out into the forest, to feel nature, and to hear the birds, and to be able to listen to the crash of the waves on the rocks. And that was an amazing effective therapy. All it was, these people in Sydney were in the town for far too long, totally unnatural, totally just nothing to draw them out, so they went inside and got very negative about themselves and life. All it needed was this beautiful nature. You can't resist the beautiful nature, it just takes you out. Every time I walk past the big view, you know, I'm on the 12th floor, you walk past, go to the elevators and look through the window, this beautiful scenery of the Genki Highlands. You can't resist looking at that. It's beautiful. It takes you out from the world of your thoughts into the real world of seeing, hearing, feeling, especially on the body. So that's what walking meditation can do. It can get you alive, feeling your body, this vehicle in which you live, which you take for granted, and you're actually feeling it. But please do so with your socks off. So you can actually, it might be a little bit cold, but it's not that cold. It's not like walking on the Antarctic, on the ice. So it's still nice and that. And you get really alive. And you can become so peaceful, just feeling all the sensations in the body. So that's for the walking meditation. And how long? However long you like. We don't have real schedules here. Because I rebelled against schedules when I was a monk. You know, we had to meditate for an hour. So you'd be sitting down there, and the head monk did have a gong. And there were some times I was praying, please ring the gong, please, I've had enough, I want to get up, I want to go to the toilet, I'm hurting. And I don't know about you, but I had all these schemes and plans, I started planning out how I could work the system. And I wanted to get one of these little slingshots, a little rubber band between two sticks, and get like a piece of gravel from outside, and train first of all. So during the meditation, if I really wanted to finish early, I would actually aim for the bell with my little slingshot. Bing! And the head monk would know what happened. Where did that ding came from? We'd all bow and go out. That way I could end the meditation early. When I wanted to, instead of this big shot. But there's other times I was sitting there getting really peaceful, so calm. Oh, things going bang, gong, get out and do something else. Oh. And I started to think then, what would have happened if the Buddha had a gong under the boat? Mark, gong, okay, well, I'll keep it. You would have got him right. So I really don't like schedules. I want to keep it natural. So use it however long you're happy. You walk meditation, however long you feel comfortable. It comes at home, yeah, this is enough now. And you change your posture. Instead of keep forcing it, Now please don't try and beat your record. It's really silly. PB. Personal best record. I don't call it PB for me, personal bullshit. Ridiculous. We're trying to overcome the sense of self, not to actually enhance it, right? Wow, I did 1 hour this morning. 1 hour, that's my best. I've never done an hour before. And then the other neighbor says, an hour? That's nothing. I did 2 hours. And so, 2 hours. I did that last year. I did 3 hours. 3 hours? I did that years ago. Real meditators, 4 hours. I don't even ever see that. I've seen that. Absolutely ridiculous. Nothing to do with Buddhism at all. It's ego, sense of self, boom. And I like Ajahn Chah's saying. Because he said, because the other monks were into that, seeing how long they could sit. And he said, monks, now it's for you lay people. If it really matters how long you sat to become enlightened, if you need to sit long periods of time to get enlightened, then all the chickens in Thailand will be advised by now, because they sit for days on their eggs without moving. So people who try to sit for long periods of time, just now to beat their record, that's called chicky meditation. And make your lifetime be reborn as a chicky, because you learn how to sit for long periods of time. That doesn't matter, that's the quality, just how it feels, and so keep it natural. It's going well, carry on. If it's time to get up, you realize, no, it's time to get up. Time just to change my life. And then when it became natural, it was much easier, much more relaxed, and much deeper than meditation. And don't worry about, well, it has some important times for the schedule. I don't mean the morning chatting, that's not important. I don't mean the 8 o'clock talk, that's not important. I mean the breakfast and lunch, that is important. That's the only schedule you really need to keep. And it's very strange, you know, people do sleep in. They don't hear their alarm clock. That's natural. They do miss the morning chance. That's natural. They do sit down, they don't know how many hours have gone past when they're meditating. That's natural. But I guarantee that when it is time for breakfast, you'll know. You'll come out for whatever you're doing, whether it's deep sleep or jhana. Time, that's fine. You'll never miss that. And the retreat people, yeah, they miss morning meetings, they miss talks, but they never miss breakfast or lunch. Never. So they don't have to worry about that one. So they try and keep it quite natural. Now, when it comes to sitting down here, yes, you calm the body down. That should be really nice. And a bit of laughter and happiness also relaxes the body. Have you noticed when you laugh, your body gets nice and loose and relaxed, easy? I don't just crack jokes during retreats just for the fun of it. There's an ulterior purpose there. It's a skillful means. And otherwise, you get some people get very bored, very negative. What have I done this for? I'm supposed to be on holiday today. I'm sitting down here, not eating in the evening. So making it happy actually engages people in meditation, draws them in. And as you draw in, your body relaxes, a bit of laughter is good for the body, your mind becomes peaceful and joyful, energized, and so you become easily peaceful. And then there comes the time when your mind is peaceful enough, you can start going on to the breath meditation. Now for years I thought, why the breath? Until I realized that it's a natural part of meditation, whether you want it or not. And this insight arose, again, when I was still a lay person, in England, a Buddhist, and it was so hard to choose which particular group you could go to, because there wasn't many groups around at all. So I didn't care whether it was Tibetan, whether it was Japanese, whether it was Thai, whether it was Sri Lankan, any Buddhist. I was so hungry for Dharma, I'd go anywhere. So when I was staying in the north of England, that I heard there was a Zen retreat being held. I'd never done Zen meditation before, but it was a chance to meditate for the weekend. So off I went, walked in, went on this meditation course. But it wasn't the same type of meditation as I'd done before, because we all were in this little hall, benches on either side of the hall, and we were told to sit facing the wall and keep our eyes open. Now, I've never done that before, meditate with my eyes open and facing the wall. I didn't know what I was supposed to do, which was very helpful. The more you know, the more complicated it gets. So we're just sitting there, just with my eyes open, watching the wall. Now, it was important that I'd meditated before, so I knew how to calm my mind down and let go of the past and future and have very few thoughts. That was an important part of what happened next. So just really peaceful, just watching this wall, and then the wall vanished.
which was one of the weirdest things I ever experienced. But this was, I think, 1970 or something, or 71. In those days, you know, for a young person like me in the West, weird was awesome. I love weird stuff. That's why I went to, you know, try and find ghosts and do psychic research and stuff. I was really into weird stuff. So, when the war vanished, cool. That was awesome. Yeah. So, it was like a war was there, and it was not there anymore. Gone. Finished. Now, of course, you know, afterwards, started contemplating, you know, what happened? That was really strange. But of course, it was very obvious why that had happened. Because it's just the nature, any doctor would know this, the nature of the brain. It only notices things which change. If things stay still long enough, like the hum of the traffic, you can't hear it anymore. Now you can, because I've pointed out to you. Because the hum of the air con or something's coming anyway, maybe the lights. You can hear that hum now, but after a few seconds, it will turn off. Your brain will not pay any attention to it. Because it's not changing, it's not important. The taste of the saliva in your mouth, can you feel your saliva now in your throat? Gone, that's a problem for you. But after a few seconds, you won't feel it anymore. Even when you close your eyes. When I close my eyes, the first thing I notice is the inside of my eyelids. Only for a few seconds. Because it doesn't change, then start turns off. You're not seeing anything. You're not seeing blackness of inside of your eyelids. You're not seeing anything. Sight vanishes. It turns off. And that became really important for understanding how meditation works. You keep things still so they can disappear. You don't need to be in an absolutely silent place, but as long as the ambient noise doesn't change, it can be next to a busy highway. After a while you don't notice it anymore, so it doesn't change. You can have ache or pain in the body, a pressure in your bottom sitting on a chair. But after a while, it disappears because it's not changing. You close your eyes, sight turns off. In a place which is not absolutely quiet, but just the same sound all the time, sound turns off. Smell, as long as no one passes wind. If there is anyone here with indigestion, and you do have bad digestion, always passing wind, please, out of compassion, still at the back. People who fart a lot and sit in the front are very cool, because so many people behind them don't smell. If you're in the back, only the wall smells it, not here. So now you know why all the people in the back. But if it doesn't change after a while, smell turns off, taste turns off, the most difficult thing to turn off is your body. Yeah, you keep it reasonably still and sit comfortably, that's why you have to be comfortable. Aches and pains that don't let you be free, you always notice them. When you're really comfortable, reasonably comfortable, after a while, you can't feel your legs. They haven't got them now, they're just not there anymore. You can't feel them. You can't feel your hands, you can't feel your head. Your body is vanishing. You can't feel it. But the last thing which is left, because it doesn't become still, your breath, that becomes one of the last things which disappears, because it's still moving. That is why, when we meditate, we calm down everything else. Sight vanishes, sound vanishes, smell, taste, most of the touch, till the last which is left is the breathing. So when you meditate, make your mind very, very peaceful. It happens naturally. You can become aware of your breath, because that's the last thing which is moving. So for me, because I've been meditating a long time now, I never actually got looking for my breath. Just calm down, be very still, very peaceful. Things turn off very quickly. And all I've got to do is my breath, nothing else. Can't hear anything, can't feel any other part of the body, and that's great, you can't feel any other part of the body. My body is always itchy. It's not my nose, it's my hands, it's my head, it's something needs an itch. It doesn't need an itch, it needs to be taken to the toilet. And then come back there, need to have a drink of water, so I need to go to the toilet again, which is endless. But when you get into deep meditation, you can't feel the body at all. Ah, oh, so much bliss. When I was in Thailand as a young monk, big problem was mosquitoes. Lots of them. Now, I think I've already mentioned to a few of you that in many places, many villages in the northeast of Thailand, when I went walking around there, I was the first Westerner they'd ever seen. Some villages had never seen a white man before, let alone a white monk. That's how remote it was. And not just the people. We were the first white men, the first Western food the mosquitoes have ever encountered. And you know what it's like when you get a new cuisine in town? Everyone wants to try it. Mexican. Oh, let's give it a try. You know, right, you've got to give it a try. So that's what happened with us. All the mosquitoes told their friends, hey guys, it's Western food in this monastery. And it's actually true. You'd look, you'd be covered in mosquitoes. Those Thai monks didn't have one, not one at all. Those mosquitoes in China were racist. They wanted to buy us, and that's the Thai monks. Maybe they'd been biting and eating on Thai monks for years and years and years. This was something strange and different, no, exotic. Exotic food. And that was very hard. Worst thing was, this, we were monks. They really wanted to. But you couldn't. You weren't allowed to squat. And those mosquitoes knew that. And they took a party from us. And also the lay people. Look at me, look at you. How much more exposed skin have I got? Forehead, head, shoulders, arms. Literally, there's more seats on the dinner table than I see on the ceiling. So they took advantage. Okay, but Ajahn Chah, he didn't have many mosquitoes on him at all. He was tired, but for us, he'd meditate 2 hours in the jungle every evening, and he got covered in mosquitoes. Together, this was, I don't know why we played these stupid games, I think this was another monk. And, you know, he counted how many mosquitoes he could notice on one time. And my record was about 70 at one time. Because more than that, he actually was too close together, he couldn't actually resolve it, he couldn't actually distinguish them. Now that was a lot of mosquitoes. But we were tough. We did it tough in those days. It was very intolerable. And so often you'd open your eyes, and you just want to run. But Ajahn Chah was right in front of you. If he wasn't there, I would have run. So, I had to do something else. So what I did, I just did my meditation. As soon as possible, just to let my body disappear, let it vanish. So you couldn't feel any mosquito on you at all. So they might be biting you, just you totally turned off the sensation of bodily touch, deep inside, having a good time inside your meditation. You couldn't feel mosquitoes at all. And I thank those mosquitoes for teaching me that. Because I had to, my back was against the wall. Other, if my mind wandered, you'd feel all this irritating mosquitoes biting you. And fascinating thing, for years I thought this was psychic power. Because when I did good meditation, there for a couple of hours, when I came out afterwards, you couldn't see any like little bumps on your arm. Usually, as a Westerner, if a mosquito bit you, you had a little welt afterwards, just the nature of our skin. I looked, there was nothing there at all. And I thought, wow, in meditation, it's like in a force field around you, impervious to mosquitoes. And I thought, this is, you know, one of the psychic powers. Deep meditation and nothing, they're trying to get in there, but you can't find a way to do that. That's what I thought. So later on, when I was
back in Australia and reading journals.
Actually, the reason was, it's a fascinating bit of insight into the nature of mosquitoes, is that they're attracted to the carbon dioxide which comes up in the skin. The more you metabolize, the more carbon dioxide comes out, the more mosquitoes know you're there. That was one of the reasons the Westerners got bit a lot, because, you know, because of our metabolism come from a cold country, we'd actually metabolize more than the tides. So actually, literally, more carbon dioxide would be coming out of our pores. So we were actually far more visible. We might wear fluorescent jackets, so mosquitoes can see us a long way away. But once I started really calm down, become very, very still, my metabolism went really almost to zero. So hardly any carbon dioxide was coming out of my skin at all. That's why I became invisible to the mosquitoes. Just face the science. But these days I tell people, the more you worry about mosquitoes and dengue, malaria, whatever it is, the more you're worried about them, the higher metabolism, the more mosquitoes, the more you're afraid of them, the more you say, mosquito, I'm over here. So the very, very least, just relax and just be calm. Metabolism goes down and you get less bites. That's it. But anyway, but what was happening there, my body was vanishing. And so with it, mosquitoes couldn't find me. It is so similar to modern day computer screens. If you don't click the mouse or tap on the screen, what happens after a couple of minutes? It goes blank. It turns out. It's exactly how your brain works as well. You don't use it for a couple of minutes. It just goes blank. Sight stops, sound stops, smell, taste. Just a breath there. You don't do anything. You just watch it. And then what happens next is your breath gets so calm. Because again, you're not metabolizing. You don't need any oxygen. You're not putting your car in the garage. You don't need the petrol, the gas anymore. You get so calm. Hardly any oxygen is needed. Until your breath is so smooth and still. But then, your breath disappears. It's hardly moving. And that's where all your five senses have now vanished. Turned off. And all you have left is the sixth sense, your mind. And that is where beautiful lights come. Five senses gone, we call it nimitta, the light is all that's left. And sometimes people ask, does everybody see that light, that nimitta? And I say, yes. Everyone in this room will one day see that nimitta. If not in meditation, when you are dead. Haven't you heard people have near-death experience? Their body sort of dies temporarily and they go floating towards the light. That's exactly what you're seeing in meditation, the same thing as your mind. Just how you experience the mind, that light. What is dead? Your senses turn off. Properly. Here you're just turning them off temporarily. They turn on again after. It's perfectly safe. I haven't had anybody die in my meditation retreat yet, and I've been teaching for many, many, many years. So you are perfectly safe, I'll give you a written guarantee, you will not die. And if I'm wrong, you won't be able to scold me afterwards. But you don't. No one knows, you're perfectly safe. So don't have to worry, your body vanishing, what will happen? You are perfectly safe, brilliantly safe. So don't worry about that, just let it go, just see what happens as the beautiful lights come up. So this is where the breath meditation fits in. It is this thing which takes you so far, starting off with when your body is nice and relaxed, that you know, not hardly any thoughts going on in your head, so you can't, you've got too many thoughts going on in your head, the wall will never vanish because you're thinking too much. That you can't let go of the body because you're thinking too much. But if you're pretty calm inside, and you're just watching your breathing, or you know, just being unpeaceful, then the breath actually comes through you, you see it, easy. is the natural path. However, sometimes people, you know, maybe later when you get more skilled, you know how to do this, it becomes so that you don't do anything. I just sit here. Don't do anything. How do you meditate? I don't meditate. I just get out of the way and let it happen. I always like telling people, try and be the passenger. Never be the driver. You just sit down here, be the supervisor, just watch. It all happens by itself. Natural, easy, and very, very beautiful. But, for many people, they just want to give it a bit of guidance. So, when you are peaceful enough, and obviously, the more we go into this retreat, the more days go past, the more peaceful you will become naturally, then you get calm enough and you feel, well, maybe I'm not going to wait for the breath to come to me, I'm going to go look for the breath. So you just, right now, ask yourself, right now, am I breathing in? Am I breathing out? Which one is it? Now. How do you know? How do you know whether you're breathing in or breathing out? There's a feeling, a sensation, an experience, somewhere in your body, it doesn't matter where, the experience which tells you are breathing in or you are breathing out, beginning of an in-breath, the end of an out-breath, it tells you where you are in the breathing. The natural way of knowing where the breath is in its cycle. Everybody can do that. But you may have noticed, I never asked you to watch the breath at the tip of the nose. I never asked you to watch it at the belly. You do it naturally. The way that the body wants to know the breath, that's how you watch the breath. Because it's important to understand this, you don't watch the tip of the nose, you watch your breath. Because if you watch the tip of the nose, you get that phenomena which I first encountered the first time I came to Malaysia, and how many years ago that was, when people were complaining about samadhi headache. They were meditating, getting headaches across their forehead. And I couldn't believe that. Meditating, getting headache. I meditate, I don't have headaches. I forget them. There's enough headaches in the world as it is without seeking more help by meditating. What on earth are you doing in Malaysia, getting samadhi headaches? And then, all those years in Thailand, never heard that, not once. And then, we figured it out. Because people were taught here to watch the breath at the tip of the nose here. That was the reason you got so many headaches. And I'll now give my demonstration in the most retreats. To do this, I will take my eyeglasses and my spectacles off so you can see my eyeballs. And usually you meditate with your eyes closed. But now I'm going to meditate on the tip of my nose with my eyes open. Because once I put my attention here, just automatically, subconscious, my eyes go there as well. And so if I could feel people are watching the tip of the nose when they're meditating, if you could feel the eyes like, this is what you'd be doing. Going cross-eyed. And if I maintain that posture for about half an hour, I'm going to get one hell of a headache across here. That's one of the reasons why people get some mind headache. Because when they put their mind in, their eyes automatically go where their mind is looking. They become a little cross-eyed. You get tension in the eyes, which causes headache across here. So for goodness sake, don't watch the tip of the nose. Watch your breath. Are you breathing in or breathing out? You don't need to watch the tip of the nose. And the second thing is the belly. If you're on a retreat, do not watch the belly in the evening time. Because that is right next to your tummy. So if you're watching the rise before you have to go, and you feel, oh, my tummy's hungry, I want something to eat, it's not fair. It makes you hungry. So don't need to watch your belly, just watch your breath. Are you breathing in? Are you breathing out? Now, even if you choose to watch the breath, it should be a very easy object to watch. As long as you don't get to it when you're still thinking about it, and you're too sort of agitated. If you try to watch your breath when you're agitated, you need too much force to hold the breath. Yeah, anyone can do that. Any person in the street. Okay, watch your breath. Too forced. You can do it for 5 or 10 minutes with really strong minds. You can watch the breath for half an hour without missing one. But you're not peaceful at all. Tight, tense. You've been using willpower. And that's not part of Buddhism. It's not part of meditation. We rest the mind on the breath. And it is a very delightful object to observe. And I often wonder, why do I like watching the breath? Then I started to remember that when I was in my mother's womb, in the first weeks after birth, I'd be on her tummy after breastfeeding, rising and falling with her breath. For so many months when I was conscious in my mother's womb, you could feel that rise and fall of the breathing. That was the rhythm which you got to know and gave you the feeling of security, safety, warmth, love. There is an association with the breath, with your time in and just out of your mother's womb. That is why it's a very safe, comfortable, attractive rhythm to watch. Not fast, not slow, but very reassuring. That's one of the reasons why it's quite nice to watch the breath. It's associated with some of the most wonderful early experiences which are in your subconscious. So you just rest on the breath. Breathing in, breathing out, breathing in, breathing out. Just relaxing there and enjoying it. Now, for some people, again, if they're not peaceful enough, their mindfulness is not strong enough, they can't see much of the breath. Just in, out, in, out, in, out. And that gets quite boring. Because it's boring, it doesn't grab your attention, because our nature is just to wander off to somewhere else. So some people, if they watch the breath too early, they just lose it pretty quickly. If you can wait until you're very peaceful, very still, it's so easy to watch the breath. You see so much of it, it's really interesting, just like your feet move, which is so much stuff going on, just in one breath. You start to see the very beginning of an in-breath, like the dawn of a new day. I see those feelings just grow and grow and grow, until you get the maximum flow of breath going in to your lungs. And then it tapers off. It reaches its peak and tapers off. And it tapers off much faster than it took to actually get to its peak. Until the last bit of in-breath finishes. The last little bit, you touch, feel it, you touch it. Then the in-breath has stopped. There's this pause. You don't breathe out immediately afterwards, it's a pause. As the lungs wait, maybe absorb all the oxygen to do what it needs to do, and then it starts to exhale. Small amount at first, and then coming to its peak, and then just the last of the used air just coming out of the end. And then again, another pause. It's not just in, out, in, out. When you're really mindful, you see much more. Like turn the lights on. And it's amazing just what's happening. Just one in breath and one out breath. Remember, this is your life. You know the word for breath in Pali? It's called prana, anna, prana, sati. Anna means along with, following. Prana, the breath, sati, mindfulness. And you've come across prana before on this retreat. Prana, atipata, where ramanis, dikavadam, samadhi, ami. Prana is the word not just for breath, but for living beings. And I mentioned earlier the connection between Indian languages and Western languages like Latin. You know the word for breath in Latin? Animalis. Animal. Exactly the same as in Pali, as in Latin. Animal is the being, animalis is the brain. Prana is the being, prana antipata, the ramani. And a prana, sati, the breath. Because there's something always really special with the breath. It's been feeding you oxygen ever since you came out of your mother's womb, and it's never let you down yet. If it had, you would not be here. You'd be in an urn somewhere, in some temple. So sometimes I look at my breath and say, wow, thank you so much. You've looked after me all these years. And somehow I've been busy messing around with all sorts of stuff, not paying any attention to you. You've always managed to do your job, breathe in, breathe out. Ever since I was born, thank you so much. Have gratitude towards the breath. And it brings all this life-giving oxygen and energy and health into my body. And it takes all these toxins out afterwards. You know, if you think you've got a maid, a servant who needs some gift or something, your breath, looking after you all your life. So I look at my breath with great gratitude, with love. Thank you so much for all you've done for me over these years. And so when you look at it with some care, some love, it's so easy to watch the breath. So this is an important point in breath meditation. Never ever treat your breath like a slave. Like a servant, like a mate. Treat your breath like a friend. So I often visualize when I'm washing my breath, it's like holding the hand of a good friend just walking down the road together. I never treat it like it was my servant. I never say, breathe in, breathe out. You breathe in too fast. Don't do that again. Don't force your breathing. Instead, treat it like a good friend, with kindness, with love. Have you ever noticed that when you're with a good friend, you don't need to put forth any energy to stay together? You love one another, you relax in each other's presence. It's a good old friend. I was just went back to England again last October, visit some old friends. Oh, I remember. A few years earlier, I met one of my old university friends. I hadn't seen him for 40 years. So we went in our separate ways. And I met him, I was coming off a train from Cambridge into Victoria train station. He was waiting for me. We were just going to catch up and have a cup of coffee. We spent all afternoon together. Never stopped talking. It was just like 40 years of being absolutely nothing, just catching up, totally relaxed in each other's presence. Actually, he was an interesting character because he was brilliant. And in the insurance industry, they got these things called actuaries, which is how they work out all of the chances that bad accidents happen. And he became the top one in the whole of Europe, you know, incredibly successful in his career. Now, well known. So he was a very, very well known business person. But then I started reminiscing about my time in Cambridge, especially when he got drunk. And he went to the toilet and he came out without putting his trousers on. And now he's the head actuary in the whole of Europe. He said, please, don't tell anyone that. Poor my reputation. Well, good fun, we had other stupid things as well. So there's someone, somewhere, has got a photograph of me with all of my friends climbing to college with our girlfriends. So I hope that never goes public. Only 19 at the time, it's a stupid young man. But anyway, so when you're with a good friend, a close friend, you're just enjoying each other's company. There's no force there. That is how you sustain attention on breathing. Not concentrating, just enjoying each other's company. Just being with your breath, good old friend. I can hang out with my breath for long periods of time. We chill out together, as the kids say. Just enjoying each other's company. Ah, I've had such wonderful times with you, breath. Oh, I remember that deep meditation we had. I remember that. That was a great one. So just enjoy each other's company. So then you don't put any effort into it. It's just that, just rest with the breath. Same way you don't put any effort into being with the breath. So change the attitude when you watch the breath. This is important. This is a friend. It's not my slave. I don't owe this friend. I owe lots of it. So thank you for being with me. And then you can stay with the prayer. It's so easy. And again, it's because you're becoming calm, you're not putting forth so much effort in, more relaxed, your mindfulness gets stronger and stronger and stronger. It increases in its power. You see more. And when it really starts to become strong mindfulness, not only do you see the person from the very beginning to the end, it's fascinating, it's also beautiful. It's delightful. Your best friend, do you enjoy each other's company? Are you happy to be together? You don't force that, but happiness comes naturally. That's with my friend. Just so happy to see my friend. He looks so delightful, so beautiful. I don't need to put effort into looking at what's beautiful. Just like I said, I think, the other day, if your husband sees a beautiful girl walk down the road, he can't take his eyes off her. Don't slap him, why? It's just the nature of a man. He can't stop himself. So the same, once the bread becomes so beautiful, you can't take your eyes off it. It's wonderful. Gorgeous. Which means that you have sustained attention. And beautiful delights. You can do that for hours, just watching your breath as happy as anything. That I call the pivot point in meditation. Happiness is starting to come up in your meditation. Delight, ease, peace. From there, we get into the deep meditations. But see if you can experience what you mean. Made my really peaceful, and then I have a breath cut in. You just choose, that was the breath. And watch the breath go in and go out. Oh, this is so nice. I can do this all day. When you get to that stage, then you get the peace of meditation. In Anapanasati, it's breathing in, breathing out, enjoying the joy, the happiness, the Kriti Sutta. That's such a vital part of meditation, because from there, everything takes off. Effortless, gorgeous, bliss like you've never known before, insights which will change the way you see the whole world and yourself. More coming next, and the talk coming tomorrow. Da-da-da. Okay, any questions or comments about what we said so far? Yes. Yes.
And you demonstrate.
Yes.
And it's very effective.
I agree with you.
And today, if you start with the stillness, then
yes.
Can I just, when my mind is still, I switch on to breathing? Is it okay?
That's fine, yes. Excellent.
Because it's very effective. I think maybe you demonstrate against them, probably it's very effective.
Exactly, yes.
Yeah.
Very good. I agree with
you.
You're very good, sir. It is true. You've got to have enough stillness, first of all. And that's one of the big mistakes. People do breath meditation. They're not ready for it yet. So they have to make preparation. Just like if you paint a wall. If you haven't cleaned the wall, take all the grease off it and all the flaky bits of paint, then you make a mess of it. Preparation is always 99% of success. So you prepare the mind nice and peaceful, still. Then the breath comes up, it's so easy to watch. And after a while you learn, when is the right time to turn the stillness onto the breath? You just learn, it's very hard to tell somebody, give it some time and see what happens. If it's too early, you can't keep the breath. Now you realize, oh, that's too early. So after a while you notice, my mind is now peaceful enough, I can just go onto the breath. It's just so lovely. So easy. But sometimes people think that meditation is difficult. It's only difficult if you don't follow the instructions. If you follow the instructions, it's in such a beautiful, peaceful, easy way. With huge benefits all the way. Okay, any other questions? Yes?
Do we follow the breath, feel the belly up and down?
No, if the breath wants to go down there, fine.
But a lot of the time, you just know it's going in. You don't need to notice where it's going in. If it's going out through your left ear and then back through your right ear. Now, I say that seriously because sometimes it feels weird. So you don't choose where you're going to watch the breath. Let the breath tell you where it wants to be watched. You know, sometimes people lose the breath. And it's just like, you know, maybe working for the Malaysian Secret Service. And you're following a suspect, you're following Ajahn Brahm. And then Ajahn Brahm goes into the girl's toilets. What does the Secret Service person do? He's not supposed to go to those toilets, he's a monk, he's a man, he should go in there. It doesn't matter, wherever it goes, the Secret Service has to follow, whatever it is. So the same with you watching your breath. Sometimes you expect the breath to be the tip of the nose, you expect the breath to be in the belly, it's not there. So you lose the breath. It's somewhere. So as someone is being mindful, you have to watch the breath wherever it happens to manifest. You don't choose. You just watch. If it happens to be in the belly, fine, that's where you watch it. If it happens to be in your left toe, that's where you watch it. So you don't choose. You just watch. Like a Secret Service agent. That's what I told people in Perth before I left. Someone was asking me, I said, well, why do you travel around so much? Well, why, when you travel around, you bring donations back to the ministry? Where do they come from? I said, actually, it's about time I let people know the secret that being a monk is only a cover. I work actually at MI5. What a great cover this would be, like being a monk. No one ever suspects. So when I come to Malaysia, I'm going on a mission. Oh, you think I've come on, Ajahn Brahm? Do you believe me? See how effective my cover is? No one ever suspects. No, I'm not. I'm not a secret agent. But then, if I was, I'd say that. You know, it's a weird story that one of the monks in England, his sister actually did work for MI6. And she would just disappear. No, she said she had a job in the city somewhere. So, you know, she'd dress up for the secretary job. And it's only recently, when she retired, she let the brother know. Said, actually, all these years, I've been working for MI6. No one ever knew. And the reason was she had one of these perfect photographic memories. So she could look at some of the documents, she would look at it, and she could record it perfectly. So they sent her, you know, this was when the Soviet Union was alive, they sent her to the Soviet Union. And they get these documents, instead of trying to smuggle them across the borders and get caught, they just get them out for a few minutes. She'd look at the video, photograph them, look at them, look at them, look at them. Then she'd come back to London, go to the head office, and then write all down exactly what she saw. That was her skill. So she was a real spy. A real one. And no one ever knew. Amazing, isn't it? So that's one of the reasons, if you do get psychic powers, don't tell anybody. Otherwise, you will be made to become a spy. Imagine if you could read people's minds. You wouldn't even interrogate anybody. You just have a look at the mind. I've got all your secrets. I know Osama bin Laden's personal telephone number. So that's why, if you do develop any psychic powers, please keep quiet. Otherwise, you become like a spy. With psychic powers. Sometimes you actually do a movie like that about the monk who worked. What is the Malaysian Secret Service called? It's too secret.
Oh,
that's what you thought, isn't it? I always say, God. Anyway, any other serious questions? It's fine. Yes. Okay, sometimes the mind is very peaceful, the breath is very still, and it disappears. So what do?
Nothing. Never do anything.
You're not unconscious, you're aware of something. When your breath disappears, just stay with whatever you're aware of and get to know it. After a while, you get to know what that state is. No breath, you're not unconscious, you're aware, and that's why. And then once you get used to that state of breath going, you can relax in there. You don't do anything. When you do stuff, you mess up the whole process. You disturb it. Then you just notice, after a while, mindfulness gets stronger and stronger. What is happening is, every stage of meditation is like a more difficult test of mindfulness. To watch the breath and to sustain it, you have to be pretty mindful. And as it gets more and more refined, it gets harder to watch. There's less of the breath there for your mindfulness to grab onto. So when it gets very, very refined, you need a very strong mindfulness, very clear, to be able to perceive the very refined breath. And then the breath gets so refined, your mindfulness is not up to task. You can't find anything. The breath is still there, but it's too subtle for that present state of mindfulness to notice. But you just stay there, relax a bit more, mindfulness gets stronger and stronger, then you can notice that very, very, very refined breath, which for most people say it's gone. No, it's still there, it's very refined. And then eventually from that comes these beautiful lights which you can't miss. Those are the nervous. They're coming. So just wait there. And after a while, mindfulness gets stronger and stronger, and then it's easy to watch. So if you have a greater taste of mindfulness, just to sit down needs some mindfulness, but not that much. But deep going meditation, your mindfulness gets very, very powerful. Very perceptive. Just similarly, which I sometimes give, sometimes teaching retreats, I go stay in hotels. And the worst hotels are where they have these shady mirrors. I hate those shady mirrors. The mirror I've got here in the room, that's fine, you can't see very much. Shave a little bit and it's good enough. But these shady mirrors are so clear, tiny little stubble, you can see it. Just like a wicker's face and a tiny little spot there, you can see it straight away. But you know, if it's only a dull mirror, and then you get away with nothing, just go off and go to work. Doesn't really matter. But those shaving mirrors, they're symbols here, very strong mindfulness. See any kind of stuff on your face again when you shave in the morning. Same with the strong mindfulness. See the tiniest of breaths, because we're very, very aware, very alert. But the lights have been turned up in our mind. See everything. And that's where you develop that stronger and stronger mindfulness. If it's not up to task, you can't go further. Losing, you don't know what you're watching. So, but after a while, the mind gets so strong, even when the breath is really starts about to disappear, you can see it. You can experience it. That's really amazing. So this is what happens. Deep and deeper, stronger mindfulness. All the way. Now, with the stronger mindfulness, it always comes with stronger energy. And joy and happiness. That's why I say, in this meditation, you get to that stage of watching the delightful breath, and from there, wow, you really bliss out. And I love it when people bliss out, seeing their big happy smile on their face, oh, this is so wonderful, oh, this is good, oh, yeah, oh, I can say, wow, just, oh. Why not? There's one lady, right, one of kind of many. She came from Sydney. She said she'd have to beg and grovel in front of her boss to get a week off work. But when she went back after meditation, had good meditation, her boss told her, she sent me an email describing this. The first day back at work, her boss said, "What drug are they giving you in this firm? I don't care, but next time you bring me some back." She was so happy. He thought it was like a drug, but it's not, it's just beautiful deep meditation. And you're really happy. Any other questions for you, Michelle? Yeah?
How that is related. Stillness and the breathing.
Yeah.
Sometimes when it's so still, you think you're not breathing.
Yes.
Obviously, should we continue the not breathing stage or should
exactly,
we
yes.
quickly start to breathe?
No, no, don't disturb it. You are still breathing, otherwise you die. And you don't die. So have a bit of faith and confidence. This is fine, this is natural. And just enjoy the peace and stillness. And it gets even deeper. So it's perfectly safe, you don't need to interfere with it. Something has gone wrong. This is totally natural. And just you stay there, you don't care about the breath. It's still going in, but very, very refined. And eventually, this is one of the stories. Ajahn Chah, my teacher, he had a stroke and so couldn't speak for many years, about 8 or 9 years. And it looked like he was sort of in a coma, not even a coma, but just not really there. But there was something which proved to all of us that he was still meditating very deeply for all those 8 years, or 9 years before he passed away. And that was that the King of Thailand was paying for a medic, 8-hour shifts, 3 people throughout the day, 24/7 throughout all those 8 years. So with the medic was usually 2 or 3 months, all the time throughout the day and night. So one of the monks told me the story that middle of the night, Ajahn Chah stopped breathing. There was a medic, a trained medic. And the medic freaked out. "You've got to do something. He's going to die." And the monk said, "Leave him alone. He's just meditating. He does this all the time." But the medic just would not accept that. As I often say, that the medic, they all did, and Ajahn Chah would die one day, but the medic did not want Ajahn Chah to die on his ship. What a big responsibility. So, they came to a compromise, and the compromise was very, very innovative. And there was a great shame this wasn't done and recorded in medical research. Because the medic said, "Well, we'll leave him alone as long as I can take blood samples every few minutes. Because I want to make sure the blood is oxygenated. I don't know how that oxygen gets in there, but as long as there's oxygen in the blood, then I know there's enough oxygen going into the brain and other vital organs, they won't sort of be destroyed." So for a few hours, when Ajahn Chah wasn't breathing, the oxygen level in the blood maintained a natural level. Obviously, he was breathing, the heart was pumping. Where it got the energy from, it must have been burning oxygen somewhere. But the oxygen level in the blood maintained a constant level. Sometimes in Buddhism, some people say you actually draw oxygen in through the pores of your skin, some sort of osmosis. I don't know, but certainly he wasn't breathing. Even the medic couldn't see any breath. Maybe it was very, very fine, but still the oxygen in the blood was always the same. So that's why he said, "Well, can't do any harm. Don't know how the oxygen's getting in there, but it's there." So he's safe. So that was Ajahn Chah. So it's very common in deep meditation to appear like you're not breathing. But you're perfectly healthy. So don't be afraid. Instead, enjoy. Okay, I think that's good enough for now. Those of you who have any more questions, we have the pieces of paper. And I will answer those questions as best I can this evening for you. So now, it is 10:30. Those are the interviews. I'll be in the room in 5 minutes. Those who want to do some walking meditation, we haven't done so yet, try the walking meditation. Those who want to do more let and go meditation, the toilets are outside. Those who want to try another meditation, you go to sleep, don't worry, 12:30 you'll wake up. Okay, so let's pay respects. Alright, let's start.